Well, welcome everyone. Thanks for joining us today. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is pleased to host the Southeast Coastal Climate Network's webinar series. On behalf of SACE and the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, I'd like to thank you for attending. It's your interest and support that make our work possible. My name is Erin Cameron, and I'll be the acting facilitator for today's webinar. We will be recording this webinar, so all of the lines have been muted to assure recording quality. We're going to do things a little differently today. So throughout the presentation, there will be designated opportunities for you to ask questions after each section of the presentation. If you would like to ask a question, please raise your hand using your control panel, and I will call on you to unmute your line. You can unmute your line by pressing star 6. You may also use this control to remute your lines after your question has been answered, or simply use the mute controls on your phone afterwards. We also welcome you to type in your questions using the control panel. At the very end of the presentation, we will have an additional question and answer session, and if your questions are not answered during the presentation, they will be at this time. And so now I'd like to turn it over to Chris Carnevale, SACE Coastal Climate and Energy Coordinator.
Thanks, Erin, and thanks everyone for attending the webinar today. My name is Chris Carnevale, and I'm the manager of the Southeast Coastal Climate Network. As you can see on the current slide, the Southeast Coastal Climate Network is a coalition of individuals and organizations spanning the coastal Southeast who are working on coastal responses to climate change. We have members as far north as Maryland and as far west as Louisiana. The purpose of the network is to bring voices together, to trade information, and to synergize our efforts. The Southeast Coastal Climate Network is hosted under the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Our largest tool is our group site website, which is an online platform that enables members to send group emails, post discussion topics, or relevant news to discussion boards, and use a shared group calendar. If you're interested in joining the network and using these tools, please just visit the website on the screen now, seccn.groupsite.com, and click Join this group now. For those of you on this webinar who are already members, I want to encourage you to use these tools to help get your message out. The purpose of the group is to encourage communication and collaboration, and you have a receptive group of people at your fingertips. So please don't be shy and use the web tools to your heart's content. Another great tool we have is our webinar series, of which today's webinar is a part. Today we're joined by Richard Delaney, president of Delaney & Associates Incorporated, to talk about public participation and engagement in light of difficult social and environmental problems. Delaney & Associates has been supporting local, regional, and national engagements for almost 20 years. Richard is North America's most active IAP2 certificate trainer, is a certified professional facilitator, and holds several other certificates in engagement-related fields. He has an undergrad in forest technology, as well as a master's degree in public policy and administration. Richard has supported over 300 engagements as a consultant. He spent the first 15 years of his career with provincial and federal government leading environmental and property management programs. With that, I'll turn it over to Richard.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, and thanks to Erin. Thanks to both of you for inviting me to speak on this topic, one that I'm absolutely passionate about. And as Erin mentioned, throughout the course of the session today, we'll pause 5 times to ask the audience or to give the audience an opportunity to ask questions for clarification, to make comments, anything to move the dialogue through, because, in fact, that's what our business is really all about. It's about getting people to talk together. So anyway, the session today I labeled Creating Spaces for Productive Social Dialogue, because productive social dialogue does not happen by accident, and it won't happen in a vacuum. There are things that have to be done. And in fact, the subtext is using community and stakeholder engagement to change minds and futures. And in fact, it was somebody much wiser than I who said, insanity is actually doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So we absolutely, if we're going to solve the large social, environmental, and financial problems, we need to start thinking differently so that we can do things differently. And clearly, the starting place for thinking differently is speaking to others with a different perspective. Next slide, please. So with that as a backdrop, we've developed a webinar, a presentation here that's going to last about 50 minutes, including the question periods. that will focus in five areas. We're going to look at wicked problems, which include all range of problems, and I'll talk about that in a second. We're going to talk about values-based engagement, and then I'm going to present very briefly the International Association for Public Participation Values. This is an international organization that sets the standard for community and stakeholder engagement planning. Then we'll talk quickly about sort of what is public and stakeholder engagement in its purest form, and look at engagement tools and techniques. And these are the things that we need to be doing differently. Next slide, please. So I'd be interested to know if people have heard the term wicked problems, but it is a concept that sort of was developed in the late 60s, early 70s, and it talked about a whole range of problems that have certain characteristics. And the whole idea there is one of my heroes, my academic heroes, is a fellow by the name of Henry Mintzberg from the University of from McGill University in Montreal, in the Faculty of Public Policy, and he says that a problem well defined is half solved. And so, really understanding when we're dealing with a wicked problem is part of developing the solution. So, wicked problems typically are defined as those which are really hard to describe. In fact, because the scope of them is expanding. So when we try to get our arms around the problem, we find that it's actually related to other areas of social, environmental, or financial endeavor. So definition is a problem to start with. The other problem is these problems typically don't have an end to them. Most problems we say, well, we'll just wait it out, and you know, at the end of the day, it's it can't get any worse. The thing with wicked problems, so I'm talking about illiteracy, poverty, climate change, environmental degradation, invasive species, all of those things, there is no stopping rule. Another characteristic of wicked problems is the solution requires levels that are beyond a true and false. That is, they're complex in the sense that there's lots of gray area that we have to deal with. The solution itself has to change the system. So the system is, we can't work within the existing system that the problem lives in. There's a need for a system change. And because of that, we can't really test these things in real life. We can model them. We can say, okay, well, what do we need in terms of technology or public policy or, you know, a regulatory framework? But, you know, it's really, you know, you're not going to develop this whole regulatory regime on a whim or on a best guess. So the solutions are really hard to test. And wicked problems are typically unique. And not only are they unique, but they actually generate problems in other areas of society or the environment, etc. So next slide, please. So they're really big problems, and they require a systems approach to dealing with them. Because they worsen over time, so we're talking about clean energy and climate change here, so we can see that without a change, they are going to worsen over time. And not only that, they are going to generate new problems. So, for example, in the area of the world that I live in, we have a whole host of new diseases, invasive species. So these are problems that are generated from climate change, as an example. So what it really speaks to is a system that's really out of alignment. It's imperfect, or there are things going on inside the system. So when I'm talking about a system, of course, I'm talking about sort of the way we live our lives and run our economy in terms of fossil fuels and that sort of thing. So we are out of alignment or out of sync with the environment within which we live. And so there's a change required. And because it's a whole system change, then it requires a great deal of coordination. Next slide, please. I said coordination, but I guess I should have said collaboration. Because really just to to communicate and to request that people do things differently, and that to tell other groups and individuals, whether it's, you know, families in a neighborhood or whether it's government in a nation, it's just not going to cut it to be better communicators. We have to collaborate. So not only do we have to communicate, we have to engage and collaborate, because there are actions that are required, actions that are different, that support our common interests. So there's a need for common understanding in terms of the problems that we're trying to deal with and the actions that we need to take in order to deal with those problems as a society, as a community, and as a household. So we have to accept that there is a common stake to deal with these problems, and that there are actions required by every individual and organization that is part of the system within which that problem is living. So one of the things that collaboration will do is it will eliminate or guard against the free riders within the system. And so whether it's developing legislation for carbon standards, or whether it's developing economic mechanisms to manage the amount of carbon that goes into the air, you know, the changes that are required will guard against the free riders. And so what that speaks to is, because free riders are stakeholders too. They have a stake in the system, and they need to be engaged. So solving wicked problems means doing collaboration better and more broadly, which speaks to dealing with the stakeholders in the system. Next slide, please. So what's a stakeholder? This is probably old hat to everybody on the line, but I just thought we needed a common understanding. So a stakeholder is anyone or organization that holds an interest or a stake in a pending decision or an activity. And so, for example, if you're conducting a business and you're generating pollution, in emissions, you have a stake within that environment, within that industry, because if somebody tells you can't emit to the same levels, it's going to have an impact on you. So because there is an impact in a decision, i.e. creating a new piece of legislation or standard, then you have an interest, and you actually have a right to participate in that decision-making. And a stakeholder, you know, if you really don't have the right, or if you can't access resources to support your rights or your stake, then really you're not a stakeholder, you're a victim. And we need to guard against this, because even if people don't have the resources to be engaged, we need to bring them into the discussion, because as we'll see in a minute, the basis for durable decision-making is, in fact, a holistic approach where all those people or organizations that are impacted have ownership of the solution or the decision. So another definition of stakeholders are those groups or individuals who can organize for common purpose in influencing the decision. Next slide, please. So this is all kind of, you know, provides a foundation for the discussion that's about to follow. And I just would ask the group to think about, so that we can provide some context to the discussion that, you know, for the rest of our session today, can you think of sort of one permanent solution that you've seen to a wicked problem? In terms of any, like an environmental problem that's wicked, or a social problem, a financial problem, and then to think about how it was solved. So I just need some confirmation that we've got sort of a common understanding of the context for collaboration and public engagement. Any thoughts there?
I'm currently not seeing, this is Erin, I'm currently not seeing any hands raised through the GoToWebinar control panel. So if you would like to participate, please just *6 to unmute yourself.
Well, rather than people thinking about who's going to be the first one to speak, I'll just leave it at that to say the purpose of that little space that we just opened up was really to get you to think about what are the wicked problems in in your system, in your life, in the business of your organization, and what are the things that you're trying to solve, and do those problems have the characteristics that I mentioned before? Because if they do, then one of the things that you might want to think about is engaging the stakeholders within that system, within who are also dealing with that problem, either causing it or grappling with it. You might want to engage them into a discussion and perhaps even a dialogue, and we'll talk about those differences in a second. Okay, so one of the things about getting people engaged in a conversation, in a discussion, in a dialogue, is that we can't really start at the level of what they're thinking now in relation to an issue, the issue or the problem that we're dealing with. We really need to start at the level of values. And so let's talk about what values are. Values are actually the product of lived experience. So if you have lived through the Depression, then frugality is a value. If you have lived through a war, then peace is a value. So things that you have experienced from a very young age and perhaps all the way through your life, these are values, and you're not about to change them in a quick conversation. They're very well entrenched. They define who you are as a person, as a family, as a community, and as an organization. They actually define the traditions or the habits that you're living currently. Values actually can give meaning to your life. So, for example, corporations, one of their values is profitability or stakeholder value. And it defines what they do. So these are really important things because individuals and organizations, they hold them dearly, and they're not about to surrender them by simply being asked to do so. Next slide, please. So I talked about positions and changing somebody's mind or changing somebody's position in a casual conversation. It doesn't happen. The reason for that is because everybody has positions on just about everything. And because of media and the internet, we have perhaps a broader range of positions than we had even a decade ago. And not only are we more informed and therefore have more positions, because we can access information from such a variety of sources and continually, then we hold those positions dearly. And those positions actually are based in interests that we have. And I talked about corporations who value profitability in order to sustain the company, to sustain and expand the company. Those are interests, right? So our positions are based in interests, and our interests are based in the values that we hold. And so everyone and every organization has those positions, interests, and values. And we can see by the arrow that's shown there that if we engage at the level of positions, we're actually engaging the other parties at in a situation that is furthest away from each other, right? We sometimes refer to this as a debate. And when we're having a debate, I'm just simply trying to convince you that I'm right and you're wrong, not a dialogue. So if you click again, Aaron, we'll see that if we can actually move down to the level of interest and talk about, well, what's your interest in this matter? Perhaps I could understand that. We've actually moved the parties closer together, sharing information about the interests that they hold in this wicked problem or in this decision. If we can move the discussion to the level of values, then we've drawn the parties closer together still. So if you can click the next slide, what engagement does, or what public participation does, is it looks at where the parties are in terms of their positions and their interests, the values that they hold, and the issues or the problems that we're trying to solve. So click again there, Aaron. And through the course of discussion, if we can have a values-based conversation, we can move the parties closer together. So click again, Aaron, until we can find common values, values that organizations, communities, governments, or individuals have in common. We refer to this as common ground. And when we do that, so click one more time, Aaron, what happens is the space between the parties is filled with goodwill. And so we've moved from a debate to a dialogue. We've got goodwill instead of resentment and polarization. And the space between the parties has been filled with goodwill, which over time, if we can keep the dialogue going, will turn into trust, which is the foundation for a partnership or at least a working relationship to deal with the problems that we have in common. Next slide, please. So what are the benefits? So this obviously is going to be more than a casual conversation. It's more than a website posting. It's more than a social media campaign. It's a significant investment to put some resources in play, to do some planning, and to commit for a period of time to work through issues amongst the parties. So what are the benefits of this? You know, what's the return on investment? Well, we're going to raise the level from one of tactics to strategy. And when we can have those kinds of discussions, then we're really talking about long-term as opposed to short-term problems or solutions. So moving the discussion up a notch is really important, and it's a benefit of dialogue, investing in dialogue. I think perhaps even more important than that is it builds ownership of the decision or the solution or the plan. So if the parties can engage over time, exchange information about what their problems are and what some potential solutions that might work for everybody, now we have some ownership of the solution going forward. This eliminates the free rider problem, and it also enlists supportive action from other areas. So it's this sort of magnet of positive energy moving towards a strategic objective. That's when you have problem solving at a social level. So those are the benefits of investing in dialogue. Next slide, please. Just like to pause again. Don't be shy to type in your question or even to unmute your line, star 6. And you don't have to identify yourself if you don't want to. But I would like to think about, I would ask you to think about your organization, the people that you work with, or maybe even the community that you live in, and what are some of the shared values that you might be able to identify. And this is important because it provides you a starting place for dialogue. And then the other thing I'd like you to think about is, if that's not clear to you, are there any areas where you've seen organizations or individuals come together to move forward collaboratively? And if so, what do you think might have been the common ground for action? Because that would help us to identify the values that are at play there.
Richard, this is Chris here. And this slide brings to my mind a shared value that has brought, I'd say, non-traditional partners together in some of the environmental and energy work, being fiscal responsibility. That's something that seems to speak to everybody. And there's been some kind of unusual collaborations that have occurred between partners who probably wouldn't normally even talk to each other, really, and would be maybe opposite of each other in their positions, come together over this value of fiscal responsibility. And we've seen this play out in our work with some of the nuclear financing mechanisms. And then also last month we had a webinar about the insurance reform, coastal insurance, property insurance and flood reform coalitions forming where conservationists are coming together with very conservative groups who oppose, basically cavalier, if you will, government spending.
And thanks for raising that point, Chris, because it's huge. It's fundamental. Going back to the starting place with wicked problems and complex systems, sometimes the systems are so complicated that we really don't even understand the system itself, let alone the problem that's driving us crazy. And if we can identify some common values and start a discussion around that, we'll attract people or organizations or parts of that system that we may be unaware of into the dialogue and contributing to the solution. I'd like to share a little anecdote. Last year, we sponsored an IAP2, so that's an International Association for Public Participation certificate program for the wind energy sector in Canada. And so I got a few registrations from folks in the nuclear business and cogeneration as well, and I shared this with the host, and he was quite concerned about, these folks are, we're always at each other, and, it's maybe we should rethink, if we're going to limit participation to this training. And I encouraged him to keep it open and to have an open mind. And in fact, after the week of training, he said, that was fantastic. He said, I'm so happy that you didn't, you didn't agree with me at the front end and limit registration. He said, they're in the same boat as we are. I mean, that's a quote. He said that. He said, the nuclear business is in the same boat as the wind business because they're facing the same challenges. They're bumping up against the same kind of NIMBYism. And in fact, it's preventing durable solutions to our energy problems. So thanks for that, Chris. Moving forward then, if you can bring us to the next slide, the third session, and I'll pick up the pace a little bit here. I can see we're halfway through our webinar. But I should tell the folks on the line that I only have about 45 minutes of material. So if people don't start asking questions, we're going to finish early and I'm going to look bad. So please do, don't be shy in asking your questions or even making comments or challenging me on the things that I've said, and we can have a good discussion about it. So I mentioned before the International Association of Public Participation for Public Participation is one of three international organizations who are really looking at what is authentic community and stakeholder engagement and how should we do it. So if we can put our arms around what is meaningful engagement, then there must be a way to do it. And so IAP2, an organization called Accountability from the UK, and the ISO organization, the International Standards Group, have developed standards on how to go about engaging the public. I have to say, too, that they have detailed protocols on how to plan for public participation, and the European Union has a directive which includes standards for public participation, which really is evaluation criteria, and it's quite good as well. So there are lots of big organizations out there who have been thinking about this, and this particular organization, the IAP2 organization, says that the first and most important value that we bring to the conversation as a group of professionals who are really all about hosting and helping proponents or decision makers in government to host conversations. What we say is that if there's somebody out there who is going to be impacted by the law that you're going to pass or the highway that you're going to build or the dam that you're going to erect, if they're impacted, then they should have a say in how you go about making that decision. So that's a value that we hold. It's a professional and organizational value that we hold as within our organization. The second one is that if you're going to invite somebody into a conversation, into a discussion, a dialogue, an engagement, then right from the outset, you really need to be clear with them in terms of how their contributions will influence the ultimate decision. That speaks to the contract between the stakeholders and the decision maker. And it's also fundamental in actually attracting people to a meaningful conversation, right? People aren't going to give up their evenings, their weekends. They're not going to spend time or money to travel to meetings like America Speaks or whatever unless they know that, oh, okay, there's going to be a report at the end of this and it's really going to go to legislators and it's going to get their attention and it's going to influence how they think and how they vote. So having that contract at the front end is really important. The third value from IAP2 is that it promotes sustainable decisions by communicating within the system all of the needs and the interests, so going back to our little model there of positions, interests, and values, amongst the stakeholders, including the decision maker. So the decision maker, whether it's government or corporation or an NGO, they have rights, they have interests and as well, and people who are getting involved in the conversation need to understand those. So we in a planning context, we talk about that in terms of givens. So there are certain things that when we're setting the stage for a conversation, these things cannot be changed, regardless of the conversation. It could be things like staffing or budgeting or laws that can't be changed or money that can't be spent. People need to know that going into the conversation. Next slide, please. The fourth value that relates to, I couldn't get that, I couldn't figure that out, Chris, sorry. So public participation seeks out and facilitates the involvement of those who are potentially impacted. And to me, it's number four. It's right in the middle of a set of seven values, and it is, to me at least, the most important. And what this is speaking to is an organization who's building, let's say, a mine site in a rural community cannot hold a series of meetings in the urban center within which their corporate offices are located simply because it's convenient for them, and then say that they've done adequate public participation. They need to actually go out to where the folks are who are going to be impacted and make it easy for them to participate. They need to facilitate their involvement if we're going to get to some kind of sustainable decision-making. Not only do we need to seek out their involvement, we need to ask them how they want to be engaged. And in fact, in my country, in Canada, there is legislation around First Nation engagement with First Nations. And one of the first principles is that we actually have to accommodate their limiting factors in terms of engagement. So you actually can't hold a meeting during fishing or hunting season and say that you've engaged a First Nation community, because we actually have to accommodate their limitations, their styles, and their preferences for engagement and communication. Next, can you click again there, please, Aaron? So the sixth one, public participation provides those people who are impacted or drawn into the conversation with the information that they need. Not, if we're going to get to common ground for action, it's going to be based on a common understanding. So everybody needs to know the rules of the game, what's at stake, who's in the game, and what their angle is. And lastly, if you can click again there, please, value number seven. At the end of the day, one of the things that engagement or participation, which we use interchangeably, those words interchangeably, what this investment seeks to do really is to build working relationships so that after the decision, we can get on with implementing it. And so fundamentally, the decision maker has to go back to those people who were involved in the conversation and tell them, this is my decision, or this is how we're deciding, and this is why we couldn't do this, and you know, we've taken this advice and we weren't able to take that advice or whatever. And so it's otherwise it's simply decision making in a vacuum. So those are the seven values that the IAP2 promotes in terms of designing and implementing public participation. I'd like to get your feedback. I'd like to understand how that strikes you. For those of you who are seeing this for the first time, are there some that kind of strike you as being a little odd, or some that are no-brainers? Or next slide, please. Just comments, questions for clarification, as you wish.
Rick, I do have a question.
Go ahead.
This is Amelia Shenstone. I work for SACE in our Atlanta office. And my first thought about this process is that it sounds great, and a lot of the places where we seek to engage don't have processes like this. For example, large utilities sometimes have integrated planning processes that are supposed to include public participation, and some of them don't even really have that, and some of them have it and it's not really good enough. So my question is perhaps getting ahead of us a little bit, but what do you do in a situation where you don't have a good public participation process like this?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. Thanks for asking it. One of the reasons why I'm giving you these values is because they are universally accepted. There are governments all around the world who have adopted these values as their own. And so it goes back to that whole values-based conversation. If you're speaking with an organization who's making decisions and they're refusing to engage, that's their position. We can't have a conversation with them at the level of a position. What we can do, though, is we can simply take these seven values and say, look, here are the IAP2 seven values of public participation. They've been adopted by numerous states in our country, literally hundreds of municipalities, city councils, municipal council have adopted these. Do you think that you would be able to adopt these or agree at least in principle that these are appropriate for your organization? So now we're having a values-based conversation between the decision maker, i.e. the utility company, and those people who are impacted by their decisions. So maybe there are Audubon societies that are seeking to protect habitat for endangered species. So instead of having the tactical discussion about please engage with us on this decision before you make it, now we're having a values-based decision. And we're not going to have that fight every time they go to make a decision. If we can get them to adopt those values, then we can have a discussion about how do those values play out on a day-to-day or month-to-month basis in terms of the process that you're going to use to make decisions that impact people or things in your system. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I think in the cases I'm thinking of, they would say, nope, these principles aren't appropriate for what we want to do. We disagree with you on values.
So I guess I'm the one, the optimistic one. So now we've put some information into play, and they've responded to it, and that's the opening for a dialogue. So now the next question is, okay, so tell us what you don't like about those values. Like I said, there's literally thousands of organizations around the world who have adopted, and the momentum is growing, by the way, I have to tell you that. So please tell us kind of what you have a problem with, and you know, now we're into a dialogue, and we've got them to state their position, which is, no, we don't agree. So let's talk about your interests, and let's move this conversation into a values-based one. Does that kind of make sense? Because when a stakeholder states their stake, that is an invitation for dialogue. It's not a closed door, in my view anyway.
Yeah, I hope we can find some opportunities for that kind of conversation.
Thanks for asking that question. Okay, let's move on. Next slide, please. So what I'd like to talk about now is, so what is this kind of field or this process that we call public and stakeholder engagement? Well, there's a few things that you need to know. You can't have public participation, stakeholder engagement, public consultation, call it what you will. They basically mean the same thing. They're the same kind of process. We're going to get into some detail in a second, but there's a few things that, you know, need to be observable within the system. So the decision hasn't been made. You can't consult on a decision that has already been made, whether it's been made internally and not announced. It can't be made. And it's based on a commitment by the decision maker to be influenced to a certain degree, and we'll talk about that in detail in a second. So there has to be a commitment from the decision maker. The last question indicated that the decision maker has traditionally not been open to be influenced. I'm suggesting the need for a values-based conversation to at least move them in that direction. The process, there has to be a process created to inform those people who are impacted about the parameters of the decision. So what's the position of the decision maker? What are some of what's the information they're considering? Those kinds of things. There has to be a common understanding. And at the end of the day, what it's going to do, if we can get those conditions, then it will provoke some discussion that will hopefully generate new thinking and may even change attitudes. And we refer to this as deliberation. So if we can talk long enough and deep enough, maybe we'll change some minds and we'll actually change the future. Next slide, please. So planning for engagement, a few steps that are out there. So what I talked about before were values. Now I'm talking, that's kind of at the strategic level. Now at the tactical level, when we're doing a plan, we need to, at the bare minimum, figure out what's the decision, who's going to decide, how will that decision be made in terms of the steps that are going to be taken. What are the givens, and what's up for negotiation, and what are the impacts? And we need to know the impacts so that we can identify who will be impacted, because those are the stakeholders, right? And then we need to figure out how we can align the decision with the engagement process. And that's integrated decision making, where we actually engage the stakeholders in a step-by-step process to inform the decision as it goes forward, because complex decisions aren't usually a one-step process. So next slide, please. So I already talked a little bit about what are the benefits. So sometimes there's basically four criteria. Sometimes people engage because they must. It's the law, or it's a policy, or it's a requirement for an approval or a license. Sometimes organizations invest because they don't have all the information. They need ideas. They need information about where the minerals are, where the fish are, where we can put the road, that kind of thing. They need sort of community or traditional knowledge. They need to tap into that. Or they need to build ownership going forward. So they need to share their decisions so that people understand and they get on board. Or they do it really just to manage risk. They're trying to reduce the transaction costs and time of doing business. And I'm working with a very large wind company. It's a transnational company, and we're developing their toolkit, their framework, and their policy for public, for community engagement. And the policy says we are investing in public and community engagement in order to reduce the time between the first dollar invested in development and the first dollar generated in revenue. So there's a real business case for public participation. Next slide, please. So just click through here as I'm speaking, Aaron. So when we talk about durable decisions, everyone knows about, well, most people know about the sustainable development, where we have that three-leg stool where we have the environment, the economy, and society. Well, in this model, so just click one more time, Aaron. In this model for durable decision-making, there are four elements. Decisions have to be technically feasible, economically viable. They have to be environmentally responsible. And one thing that we're really seeing now is they have to be socially acceptable. So, we're really fighting an uphill battle in terms of getting wind farms installed because people don't want to see windmills on the horizon. Well, that's not socially acceptable, and it's causing a problem in as us as a nation, as a society, moving towards sustainable energy production. So durable decisions have to consider all these four elements, because if you click one more time, you'll see that durable decisions, in all of the information that's out there in those complicated systems, there's only a very narrow sliver where they overlap, and finding that area of durability is difficult, and we can only do it through dialogue. Next slide, please. So real short equation here in terms of how much do you invest and how do you plan. Level of impact of a decision equals the level of engagement. When we're talking about level of impact, we're talking about direct, indirect, and unintended impacts. And the level of engagement is moderate, significant, or dramatic, and that relates to the nature of the negative impacts that a community or individual or company, whatever, will feel, and that's their standing within the decision-making process. That's the stake that they hold relates to their right to be engaged. Next slide, please. So what we've done at the IAP2 is created this framework. It's what we call the spectrum of engagement, and you can see that there are five levels of engagement, and the arrow at the top says that the more the negative the impact is, the greater the need for engagement, and we move from simply informing people that we're going to make a decision to consulting with them, which is we've got three options that we're trying to select from. Can you comment on each one of those options? To involving people, which is, hey, we're developing options for this decision. Can you tell us what your concerns are so that we can factor them into our options? Or we can collaborate with them, which is, hey, we need your help to develop a few options for this decision. To empowering people, which is, hey, can you guys go away, figure out what we need to do here, and just tell us what we should do. So those are the five levels of engagement and what we refer to as the goal for the public participation. And the second row there, you can see there is a promise to the public. At each one of these levels of engagement, the decision maker actually makes a commitment to engage the public to a different level. And then the bottom row, you can see that there are different techniques that can be used at these different levels of engagement, and that's really important, and we'll talk about that at the tail end of this presentation. So we have to align the technique that we're using to the goal that we're seeking to achieve in terms of public participation. Just click through the next few slides there, Aaron. We're running out of time. These are, just pause briefly here, this is a health agency in Canada. They've adopted this. This is a federal agency, so all across the country they use this kind. You can see it's based on the IIP2 model. Next slide, please. This next one, I think, is a province. It's the province of British Columbia. They've adopted this, this spectrum, and this is how they've adapted it for their needs. And you can see on the right-hand side there, they've eliminated the whole empowerment level on the spectrum, and they've said we won't empower people, but at least we'll partner with them. And you can see the changing nature of the influence. They're the blue dot. When they go from informing right through to partnering, it's really an equity issue that they're giving up more and more influence as they move from the left to the right of the spectrum. Next slide, please. The deliberative democracy consortium out of Washington, D.C. has built their own spectrum, and you can see that they're really all about, engaging people. And when they get, they've got five levels, but actually at the fifth level is when they start making collaborative decisions, so deciding and acting together. And I assume that these slides are going to be available, so I won't go into any great detail. But these slides are here, next slide please, just to demonstrate that organizations of all types are adopting a more sophisticated approach to community and stakeholder engagement. Comments, questions about those? What is public participation?
Rick, I just wanted to, this is Erin from SAFE. We are getting quite a few questions. I don't know if you want to wait until the end or if you would like to just go ahead and start answering questions now.
Oh, well, we're almost there. So why don't we just skip to the end and hopefully we'll have time to answer as many as possible. I can't see the questions on my panel, Aaron. So anyway, I only have a few slides left to go here. So let's just go through them, and then you can read the questions, and I'll answer them as succinctly as possible.
Sounds good.
Next slide. So this is the last section that I wanted to talk to you about, that there are tools and techniques out there. And basically these techniques or processes are collaborative by design, right? They're designed to achieve specific outcomes, and they're typically step-by-step processes. They are a combination of certain actions that you take as a facilitator and instruments that you use. So instruments like social media, or instruments like keypad polling, or instruments just like an interview guide, simple and complex instruments. And for all of these techniques, and there are well over 100 of them, the collaboration is built in. So if you pick the right technique with the right group, then you will get collaboration. Next slide, please. What I've done is I've broken up for you, instead of five levels on a spectrum, what I've done is I've broken the techniques into three groups. So the first group is information giving. So if we're working on the left-hand side of the spectrum, we're really just informing people about what are the parameters for the decision and what is it. These are the kinds of things that I I would use as a decision maker or as a P2 professional, you know, phone messaging, bill stuffers, open houses, giving people information, raising their awareness. Next slide, please. The next group of techniques is about consulting people, telling people what you're planning to do, and then asking for their feedback. So here's just a sample of some ways in which you can do that. That one at the bottom there, town hall meeting, I don't believe that I've ever recommended to a client to do a town hall meeting because, in my view, they're sort of the last of the public policy blood sports. And I don't know that they're all that productive, but people certainly like them because they get to vent and yell. And anyway, we can talk about that in a second. My last slide here is the last group of techniques are techniques for involving people. So I mentioned a few of these techniques already, but they're very sophisticated structures and processes which actually bring people together for collaborative decision making. And they live on the right-hand side of the spectrum, so we're in the area of collaboration, partnering, that kind of thing. So that's all I have to say. Why don't you fire away? I know I ran through that last little section quickly, but I just wanted to group these techniques into these three different types so that you can see that, you know, if you've been to a World Cafe and you really like it, well, that means that it was selected to meet the purpose of that discussion. You can't use it for every discussion. You have to design these things as you go. So let's jump into the questions.
Okay, great. I'm going to start at the beginning here. This one is from Michelle. I think that oftentimes the community members fail to take into account the motivation values of the corporations when we advocate for environmental protection policies. If we don't understand where they are coming from, how can we work with them to create outcomes that work for everyone? Is there any way to create lasting solutions to these problems without that kind of engagement?
Well, I don't think so. I think what we need to do is, ask, we talk about governments and we talk about NGOs and we talk about corporations, but really what we're talking about is the people who work there and the way they think and how they decide. So what we really need to do is we need to ask those corporations or the individuals who represent those corporations, what is it? What are your givens? I need to understand what's motivating you. We need to have a conversation about what are your impacts and what are my impacts. And when we can put that on the table and everybody understands them, then we know what's at stake, and we can have a discussion about how to mitigate any negative impacts for the corporation, for the environment, or for the communities that we're talking about, for sure. And because it comes to respect. I mean, I can remember a conversation that I facilitated once, and it was for a mining company. And, I said, is there anybody here who's never been on a bus or driven a car kind of thing? So we all need metal, right? It kind of changed the dynamic because now everybody's part of the solution because they're all part of the problem. I hope that made sense. And I just to try and keep moving through the questions, maybe we can just skip to the next one, and we'll do follow-up if there's time at the end.
Okay. How do you identify all the groups that might be affected by an issue or decision? Who may represent?
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, you don't start with the groups. You start with the decision. So whether it's a plan or a strategy, what you have to do is you have to look at that slide said there are direct, indirect, and unintended impacts. So you do a decision analysis, and you identify all the potential impacts. Once you know what the impacts are, then you can look at who will be impacted. That's your stakeholder community.
Okay. Are there any ideal sizes for public participation meeting, as well as length of meeting and type of process?
Oh, yeah, really good question. The answer, I'm sorry to say, is it all depends. America Speaks does symposia with, 1,200 people, and they're fantastic. And I've done lots of engagements one-on-one, cofflatches, where I just meet a key stakeholder and we have a discussion. So I think the criteria are, what's the decision? Who are the stakeholders? What's the nature of their impact? Then we select then we select a technique. And when you select a technique, it will tell you, you know, the number of people, the time you're going to need, the resources, what's the context for when it's appropriate to use that. So just taking the slide that's up there now, if you were to Google any one of these techniques, you would get almost an infinite number of hits on how to do a revolving conversation or a citizen jury or a World Cafe. And all the information that the questioner is looking for would be answered in a description of that technique. So understanding the inputs for the technique isn't important. Well, it's not as important as picking the right technique, right? So you have to do that design. You have to understand, so what are your resource constraints? What are the impacts? What are you trying to accomplish? What is your P2 goal? Where are you on the spectrum? So, yeah, but, you know, once you know the names of the techniques, then, you know, you can get that kind of information from the web. Next question. And these are just an example, by the way. There's well over 100 different kinds of techniques where collaboration is built in. Are there any other questions there, Erin?
We do have some hands being raised as well. So
go ahead.
We have time for one, it looks like. Randy Bernard, are you still on the call? If so, you can press star 6 or unmute yourself. Okay, Randy, if you are able to unmute yourself, I'm going to, if you could see if you can do that, and I'll go ahead and read another question that we have. Actually, not a question, but a thank you and a comment from Jennifer Rennick with SAFE. Appreciate the framing of the business case for public participation. For example, gaining public acceptance for offshore wind becomes more critical to further the penetration of renewable energy by protecting the financial investment. So thank you for that, Rick.
You're welcome.
And it looks like we have 2 minutes, so we might have to go ahead and wrap up here. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Do we have time for another question, or are we done?
Go for it.
A question that I would really like to ask, a burning question, has been basically with that whole spectrum of engagement, how do you decide the spectrum being, you know, just informing people versus empowering people at the other end? How do you decide which level of the spectrum is right for your process, specifically given that a lot of times environmental voices seem to be drowned out by much bigger and badder voices that have more resources, et cetera? So kind of, you know, sometimes opening the conversation is a danger to the goals you're trying to achieve. So how do you kind of decide where on the spectrum to engage?
Yeah, I appreciate that comment, Chris, or that question. And it's a real danger. It's a real risk. So we have to start off with acceptance of the values that I talked about before, that it's in fact not those interests with the biggest, the largest amount of resources who can influence the conversation. In fact, it's those individuals who are impacted or who represent the most significant impacts, right? So it's being able to demonstrate that there is a significant impact that is of social concern and needs to be factored into the conversation. Now, one of the things that we see all the time is corporations and other interests who actually try to drown out that information about what is the level of the impact and how significant is that, because we see as we move across the spectrum that as the impact increases, so too should the level of engagement increase. And so it's really a technical thing of doing the analysis and saying, here are the impacts, here are the stakeholders who relate to those impacts or who are impacted or who represent the elements of the ecosystem being impacted. That gives them the right to be engaged.
Thank
And I have to say, like in South Africa, they are passing legislation that will actually incorporate that value.
Gotcha. Thank you.
And in fact, just last point on that was our whole legal system is predicated on that, and that's the concept of standing. So if you can demonstrate to a magistrate or a judge that you were impacted, then you have a right to be party to a legal procedure, right? So, I mean, there's really solid ground that we're on here. Anyway, I guess that's the last question. And before I guess I turn it back to Aaron or to Chris, just want to thank everybody for participating. And you can, if you have other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. You can send them through Chris or Aaron to me, and I'll get right back to you.
Great. Thank you, everyone, for attending today's Southeast Coastal Climate Network webinar. SACE is very excited to take part in this webinar series. We'd like to thank all of our members on this call and encourage those of you who are not members to please join us today. For more information, please check out our website, cleanenergy.org. I encourage you to also view our blog or follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And again, today's presentation will be available on our webinar archive page of our website. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Aaron and Chris. I really enjoyed working with you on this, and don't be shy to contact me in the future if you think I can be of assistance, and good luck with your endeavors.
Great. Thanks a lot.
You take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye now.